Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilda Gottlieb, author of The Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, a nonprofit living laboratory for accomplishing social change. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about our human potential for creating more healthy and humane places to live. I'm so pleased to welcome Rahul Bhardwaj as my guest on Making Change. Rahul is the president and CEO of the Toronto Community Foundation, one of the largest community foundations in Canada. Rahul's involvement in his community goes beyond just his work with the Toronto Foundation and beyond his newly appointed role as chair of the board of Community Foundations of Canada. He has participated on too many community and national boards to list here, from college and foundation boards to chairing the Toronto Downtown Jazz Festival. Most recently, Rahul has been co-chairing a program in conjunction with the 2015 Pan Am Parapan Games to generate games-related initiatives all around the community. In 2012, Rahul's commitment to city building was recognized with Queen Elizabeth's Diamond Jubilee Medal, and he was named one of the 50 most influential people in the city by Toronto Life magazine. Given the depth of his experience, not only at the Community Foundation, but the meandering twists and turns of the path that has led him to that role, it is my pleasure to have Rahul Bhardwaj share his observations with us today, here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Rahul Bhardwaj. Welcome, Rahul.
Good to be here.
It is really a pleasure to have you with us today. You have had such an interesting life, the path that has taken you to be at the Community Foundation right now. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about where did you start and how did you wind up where you are?
Because I think where I started is actually pretty far away from where I seem to be sitting right now. I was a corporate lawyer for the 90s in Toronto, and during the course of practicing law, I also got involved with a number of boards and charities, including joining the board of the United Way in Toronto, which was a real eye-opening experience. I learned a lot about how the NGO world is working and was introduced to the concept of city building. And just shortly after my time on the board, actually I was still on the board, I was invited to join the Toronto 2008 Olympic bid as its vice president. And some folks may not recall this, but around the year 2000, Toronto was vying to host the 2008 Olympic Games, which ultimately went to Beijing. But that was a remarkable exercise in a number of ways. One, I had left the practice of law as a secondment to learn about how do we actually advance the bid and hopefully win the right to the Games. And
wow.
Obviously we didn't win that, but what we did learn was a great deal about city building. And how do we actually engage a population to get behind an idea and help shape the vision? And when I left the Olympic bid, when that was actually over, I was still really motivated by city building, and I was invited to become a CEO of a local United Way, which I did. And after doing a bit of a turnaround there, I joined the Toronto Community Foundation, and this is going on just over 6 years. One of the ironic pieces is that one of our biggest assets at the foundation right now is our Toronto's Vital Signs Report. And while I was at the Olympic bid, one of my colleagues was in fact drafting the first iteration of this report. Little did I know how important that report was going to be in my future.
We never know that we're on a path until we look behind us and see, oh, look, there's a path back there.
Exactly.
It's great. It's great. With all of that, you've got so many opportunities to look at community through so many different lenses. Through all of those lenses, when you have seen change happening in communities, what do you see supporting that change? What is undergirding it and creating that change?
That really is a good question with a really complex answer, because I don't think there's any one particular thing that one can point towards, but you know, a couple of ideas come to mind. And I think they're all around the notion of what I think has been a significant culture change. And in the one instance, institutions have really retreated from, let's say, their earlier role. And by that, I mean, when you look at government and its current role, when you look at institutions like religious institutions, they fundamentally have a different role now than they used to before. And when you couple that with, you know, the rise of individualism and how we see ourselves in community these days, I think you're finding more people really taking control and leadership in ways they hadn't before, particularly in the grassroots. And then, of course, there are many who are motivated by the notion of giving back, and this is their way to do that, too. Another way of looking at it, I'm going to quote Gandhi here on be the change that you want to see. And coming from an Indian background, I think back to my grandmother, who she passed away in just after the year 2000, grew up in a village in India, and every day of her life, you know, raising seven children in a country that at that time was quite undeveloped compared to now, she was literally changing the world every day without really knowing about it. But now we're living in a world where not only people believe they can be that change, but I think there's almost a sense of entitlement that people can actually change the world in many ways that they want to do it. So I think that's a significant culture change. And maybe the last one that comes to mind, and I'm seeing it play itself out in Toronto all the time, is as the world gets more complex and we run out of time, we run out of time for our family and ourselves and our leisure time and the sort, that people are seeking purpose in a lot of places. And actually working in community and getting involved in helping to shape that, and in a very Aristotelian sense, is really providing them purpose and an opportunity to fulfill their own nature, as it were.
Now, is that what you're seeing in terms of the word entitled when you talk about that sense of entitlement about creating change? Is it that seeking purpose piece? Tell me a little bit more about that.
Once upon a time, I believe that wanting to really change the world was something that we all worked on and collaboratively through institutions, whether it be in through politics, religious institutions, community institutions. But now the way that information travels and the technology that enables initiatives to get off the ground so quickly, and the way that that kind of goes viral, think of things like Kiva as well, how quickly that caught on in people's minds. I think that got people thinking, hey, not only should I be changing the world, but guess what? You know what? I'm entitled to do that. I should be doing that. And I think it brings a very different tenor around, because the old institutions, particularly within the philanthropic world, that were the, so we say, the repositories of the knowledge and of the connections and of the processes to make it happen, I think are struggling in some respects these days, because a lot of people believe that they can go and do it on their own.
It is very interesting to see that spirit. You almost see two things happening at once. With the rise of social media, we feel more connected than we ever did. But there is, as you're noting, that rise of that entrepreneurial spirit that I can do it. A very interesting dichotomy.
It is. I think it's bred from a spirit of competition in one respect, particularly around the entrepreneurial side. The challenge is how do you harness that energy in a collaborative fashion?
So what have you seen in answer to that question?
That's a journey. We know how to reward competition, and we built our cities and our countries around competition. We have to figure out how do we reward collaboration and really focus people on the importance of collaborating. And a lot of people have been talking about it, and I certainly don't want to leave people with the sense that it's not happening. It is, but it's early in its journey. We're learning how to do it more effectively and more often, and it's a messy venture to get into. You know, it requires trust. There's a lot of energy that puts into it. It could be extremely frustrating. But at the end of the day, I think the results tend to be much better.
It's been interesting watching, especially in specifically the community benefit nonprofit sector, but in other sectors as well, there has been a push in the philanthropic world for maybe two decades towards quote-unquote collaboration. And I put it in quotes because the old model was, in order to get a grant from a foundation, they required that you had a, quote, collaboration. So two or three groups would get together. You'd say, oh, I need three people to sign this thing. You'd have that old language of who's going to take the lead on this. There were always different power struggles. It was really collaboration in name only, in writing only. And you saw very few of them that were that sort of organic thing that you're talking about. It's so interesting to me that when people are talking about true collaboration, that word that you used, messy, frequently comes up. We've often thought about it in our work as not really messy. That connotation is never a great one, because messy is not a great word, I guess. But it's complex and it's rich like an ecosystem. It's organic. And that whole issue of trust building is such a big part of what a real collaboration looks like. in a real community ecosystem sort of way.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The messy connotation to me speaks a little to the complexity and to sort of the chaos at the beginning as well, because there's alignment around vision, perhaps even some strategies, but you've got different organizations with different timelines, cultures, levels of professionalism, experience, wisdom, and you throw that all into a mix, and it is kind of messy. It takes some time to connect the dots and, as you know, to build the trust to really move it forward. When I use that word, I certainly don't do it in a pejorative sense.
Right.
It's more of managing one's expectations when you get into it. It takes time to build trust and combine resources. But in the end, if you can get good at collaborating and you can make the culture of your organization one around collaboration, both externally and internally, I think everybody benefits.
Okay, so what does that take?
I think it takes a deliberate and an intentional view to do that. For instance, at our foundation, we talk a lot about collaboration. We talk about collaborating internally, how we do it. I wouldn't say reward it per se, but we certainly recognize it as a positive attribute. And when we think about how we want to achieve goals externally, we encourage ourselves to think big. And by the time you've thought big, you realize very quickly there's no way we can do this on our own. Then you start thinking about your partners and who could be the good partners. And once it becomes a part of your DNA to do that, you've done it enough times that chances are you're going to have some success.
You're really talking about collaboration and cooperation as a way of being rather than a thing that you do.
If you do it successfully, I believe it becomes a part of the DNA of the organization.
Do you have anything that you've been working on recently that is a story that you can share that's about that?
Where do I start? When I think about all the activities that we have underway right now, they're all collaborative. In particular, right now, we're hosting the Pan Am Games in 2015 in Toronto, the Pan Am Games. And early in the process, after we had won the bid, our foundation began a discussion with both the host organization and a series of NGOs in the city to talk about how do we create a social capital legacy around the Pan Am Games. And we started with this very nice vision and notion, but now we had to build a collaborative around it, and we actually had to have the collaborative help create the vision and the strategy and the brand all around it. And when I look at it now, we've got a host of organizations, including the city, the host organization for the Pan Am Games, a number of our partners. I think we're probably into the 100 of partners now. And it's called Playing for Keeps. We've actually started grassroots programs called Neighborhood Games, all with the view of helping to build social capital in the city, helping to connect divided communities and build stronger communities. And I smile when I look at the other cities around North America, and particularly associated with the Olympics in the UK, that were coming up with similar notions. And now I look at them, and I see the level of collaboration they required to get off the ground, and I'm not surprised in the least that we had to do the same here. But every step of the way, when we expanded the collaboration, we brought in new partners who added to the vision, added to the various strategies, who helped build it up by aligning their resources, if not necessarily contributing their resources to the program. And we're still a year and a half, 2 years away to the games. But it's really picking up steam, and people are getting aligned behind it.
What are you seeing happening in communities where you're doing the Playing for Keeps projects?
It's remarkable, the stories that you get from this. I can give you one example that really surprised me. There was a neighborhood games being hosted in Toronto during the winter. And if you can appreciate, it's tough to get people out in the wintertime to do something. And there's a particular neighborhood in Toronto that happens to have a valley in the middle of it. And on one side of the valley, there's a particularly affluent community. And on the other side of the valley, there's one that's actually struggling. It's quite diverse and with a lot of newcomers in it. And when it's described to me, it's the kids on the one side just know not to go to the other side. They don't belong, which you can appreciate is completely the opposite of any concept of social capital.
Right.
So there was a particular individual who came from the affluent community who said, let's bring these two communities together through a neighborhood game. And the game is, in fact, going to be snowman building. So building snowman in the middle of this valley. So she went about it as a playing for keeps neighborhood games, put up the posters around the community, started making some calls and convincing people to come out. Next thing you know, they're all in the valley on, I think, on a beautiful Sunday, actually making snowmen. Now, for folks who've made snowmen, they'll say, oh, this is a fun thing to do. But the transformational moment, and this is the organizer telling me this, is when the newcomers came from the other side of the valley and came down to watch the snowmen being made. And of course, they had no context for this. They'd never been taught to do this. They weren't children growing up here. They didn't know where you stick the carrot for a nose, you put a toque on it, you put a scarf around it, you've got charcoal for the eyes. They'd never had any context to appreciate that.
So when you're talking newcomers, you're talking newcomers to Canada.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And now they were being introduced to this. So now there was an incredible bridge being built between these two communities all through this moment of play. And it's very simple on the one hand, but it's quite elegant on another. And when we look at some other communities, I'm watching the videos that people are sending us in their neighborhood games, and I'm watching police getting involved in games with communities they're really struggling to have a positive relationship with. And they're running around with balloon tosses and egg races with spoons in their mouths. And you can just see it's creating a completely different level of interaction and building trust between people who are struggling building that before.
In the conversations that I have with folks from this program, people talk a lot about building trust. And I don't know that the issue of play has ever arisen in these conversations. It's so simple and so elegant. It's what we do so naturally.
I would agree with you, and we really smiled when we looked at this and said, how are we going to really build social capital? Because there's so many ways to do it, and social capital in and of itself is quite an academic term. Mm-hmm. We said we could talk about it from a burning platform standpoint, and nobody's going to respond to that. But play seemed to be such a natural way to bring people together. It releases the inner child in all of us. It's uncomplicated. Anybody can get people going. When we started to play on the streets of downtown Toronto by having little flash mobs of neighborhood games, the look on people's faces when they were introduced to skipping rope just on their way to meetings, they'd never done that before. It created connections and bonds that just didn't exist, and everybody lightened up, and you could just see them going to a better space.
What you're really doing is breaking it back down. We've talked about that the cultural change is complex and messy, and there's like nothing messy about this.
Now, organizing it and getting people aligned behind it and the whole, I would say, the back office component can be. But once it's actually revealed and people are participating in it, no, you're right. It's very elegant, and you can see the transformation in people's eyes. They're suddenly getting connected in ways they hadn't before.
Is that rippling into any of the other work that any of the participants, the organizers, are doing?
Well, we're certainly finding out that the individuals, and in many cases the organizations that we're working with, we've actually encouraged to become ambassadors for neighborhood games. This is providing them a pathway to demonstrate community leadership in an innovative way. So individuals that really want to step up into a role of community leadership as well, this provides them a pathway to do it. The organizations that are working in communities and they're already doing great work, this is providing them another arrow in their quill, really, to say, this is how we can help build community.
Are you guys playing more inside the Community Foundation?
Funny you say that, because in fact we are. And every once in a while, that play gets taken out into the streets and the intersections, which worries me from time to time, but they're all safe and it's good. It certainly draws a lot of attention.
You've got to make sure your workman's comp insurance is covering this. I love it. I love it. Some of the other things that you have mentioned is that whole issue of people seeking purpose, the combination of being the change, but also people seeking purpose in their lives. What are you seeing in terms of how is that rippling into what creates change?
Once again, on its very simplest level, I'm finding that we have a lot of people with really good education who are working in roles that are very demanding of them in their professional life. There's a real desire they have to, as some would say, give back. Others would say simply that they want to help improve the world or the city they live in. And given the fast-paced world of professional lives everybody lives in, I think people are just working so hard on that that they don't have the old traditional pathways to really feel as connected with their communities as they had before. I think in Toronto in particular, we're seeing that a lot of the cultural institutions and religious institutions are seeing a decline in attendance, etc. So people, when they come and they talk to us at the foundation, they want to take the skill set they have, plus the passion that they have, and direct it towards something productive, because it's filling something that's clearly a gap in their lives. So it's connecting their head and their heart, and it's pointing them in a direction that says, I can really impact something that means a great deal to me, and that's my community. Some people want to do it on a skill-based level, so they may have a particular skill from their professional life that they want to contribute to an organization or community. Others may have financial contributions they want to make, and others may just want to get involved in an organization and actually commit to it over the long term, over the long haul, to be a part of their own growth as well as contributing to the community.
It's been interesting watching some of the changes over the past couple of decades in community foundations. In many cases, many community foundations started out as repositories for dollars, for donors, for donor-advised funds, ways to bring together, in essence, to build a collaboration, but primarily focused on dollars. It's been interesting to watch a slow shift in some foundations, a very rapid and dramatic shift towards building more of that social capital and really tapping on not just the dollars of a quote-unquote donor-advised fund, but the other gifts, the social capital. And I think that's a big piece of where the opportunity comes from in community foundations, and largely untapped.
I agree with you entirely. We talk often about time, treasure, and talent. And the treasure part being the financial part is obviously very important. But we're finding that more donors and other stakeholders that engage with community foundations bring so many more assets than financial assets to the table. They have their talent and their skill, and they often have time, particularly if they're at a point in their life where their professional demands aren't so much. So here's a great opportunity to tap into that and connect them into the broad networks that we have to add value to help improve our communities.
Tell me about some of the things that you guys are doing that is tapping into that.
We have some remarkable projects underway right now. We just completed this year's version of what we call Vital Impact, Vital Toronto. And this is a great case where we're working with one of our corporate partners, KPMG. And KPMG has a very large footprint in the community in Toronto, and they're very keen on engaging their own staff, as it were, their professional staff in particular, with opportunities in the community. So what we've actually done is we've created an element of our grant stream, and we've integrated it with some activities at KPMG. So a host of their associates, we connected with a number of community organizations who we'd already pre-approved for grants through our own grant process. The individuals at KPMG then went and connected with these organizations, learned about them, and came back to KPMG and actually pitched their own people on who would receive a particular grant from KPMG. Now, there's the money component of this, but what was really intriguing was even those organizations that were unsuccessful in receiving a grant still had connected with KPMG employees such that these employees have gone onto their boards, working on committees, that now they've got a new level of engagement with a group of people that they never had before. On the other side, when you're looking at KPMG, particularly these young associates, they were finding their voice. When I watched them stand up amongst their peers and speak so passionately about what they'd learned about these organizations and the great work that they were doing, you could see that connection being made, and you knew it was going to be a lasting one.
You know, I wish you could see the smile that I have on my face, because what's occurring to me in all of the things that you've been talking about, we reflexively think that there's this black box, that money and time and talent go into the box, and out of that box comes somebody else creates change someplace. So we're going to fund an organization so that they will then go out and create change. What you're really talking about is building community by building community. You're building engagement by engaging people, that people feel engaged, that whole sense that people are finding their voice And that's the result that we're looking for. It's not just a means to an end, but the means is the ends in the work that you're talking about.
Absolutely. We're all about creating pathways for that to actually take place.
The journey being the result is really, really obvious in everything that you're talking about, that you're building trust by building trust. You're building a sense of play by building play. You're engaging people by engaging people. It seems so simple.
You know, there's the old adage, seeing is believing.
Yeah.
And there is a certain amount of truth to that. And when there's also the law of unintended consequences, too, that while we think we're actually doing A, B, and C, you see C, you know, D, E, and F pop up. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I was quite sure watching these young professionals connecting with community groups that they would learn more about their city, that they would create a relationship with these organizations that would at some point be symbiotic, they'd be helping each other. What I thought was really remarkable is when this large corporate entity recognized the impact that it was having on their own staff, where they were finding their voice as individuals, as young professionals, and more importantly, as members of a community that they're actually a part of creating.
Yeah. It is so funny that we have the expectation that things are going to be hard and complicated, and it really is so simple sometimes.
Sometimes. I wish it was so simple a little bit more often, but
no,
you're right, sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. You're creating the conditions for good things to happen.
That's what we're trying to do.
And that's when unintended consequences are based on some causality rather than, oh, well, look at that.
And you use the word journey, and this is something we've spoken about quite often, and it is a journey. And often it's about putting one foot in front of the other and being prepared to innovate, being prepared to take the risk that you might fail, but being also prepared to learn along the way and adjust where you need to. There's that old saying about never start anything about the end result in mind. Having an end result is a good idea. Having it too fixed in stone, not such a good idea.
Right, right. Rahul, I am so glad to have had the opportunity to talk with you. And I will share with you that when you and I met in Toronto and had a conversation, I scribbled something down that really resonated with me. And I can't think of anything that you have said today that hasn't just reinforced that. And what you said is that there are so many barriers that people think are there, and that they just need permission to go play and experiment and see what works. And I'm so glad that you shared all of this with us today. I'm looking forward to checking back soon and seeing what else amazing things that you guys are working on. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Listening to Rahul, I'm struck by his description of his grandmother, who is changing the world every day in her village in India, simply by living what it means to be the change you want to see. So much of what Rahul talked about was example after example of how being the community we want to see is the path to creating that community, not in some distant future, but right here now, where the journey and the goal become one. Working in the social change arena, it's so easy to get jaded to words like collaboration and engagement. We tend to see these as mechanisms, means to an end. We collaborate so that something good will come from it. We engage so that we can get what we want. There's the mechanism, collaboration, and then there's the goal, whatever project result we're seeking. What Rahul's stories showed over and over, though, is that a powerful result of collaboration can be simply that we find meaningful ways to work together, that the goal of engaging can simply be that we're more engaged. And isn't that what we humans want at the core? We want communities where we feel connected, where we feel like we matter. Rahul talked about that sense of purpose. He talked about people finding their voice. What more could we possibly ask from community building efforts than that people find their strength, both individually and collectively? There is one more thing that is so very striking in the stories Rahul shared and the simple yet powerful philosophies behind them. Every one of the projects he talked about makes us smile. When stories are about people connecting, they tend to be joyful stories. But when we move beyond perceived barriers and give ourselves permission to experiment, to explore, to play, that's when the magic can occur. And it's magic because even though serious community building is taking place, even though trust is being built between rich and poor, between police and neighbors, that trust in community building is using snowmen as its currency. Which leads to questions for your own work. First is a question that Rahul asked early in our conversation. The community benefit arena is so filled with competition. What is your organization doing, though, to harness the power of cooperation? When a project first presents itself, are you asking, what will our organization do, seeking partners only to gain favor with a funder? Or is your first question about truly collaborating, building something through true partnership that is far greater than what any one of you might accomplish on your own? Second, what mechanisms and systems do you have in place to ensure that your work is building trust? When collaborations fail, it is so often due to a lack of trust or someone breaking that trust. What do you do to focus with intention on building and maintaining trust among community members, between community members and your organization, and within the walls of your organization itself? And lastly, what would it make possible if the expectation in your organization was that work would be fun? Imagine if that question rang through every project, every meeting, every discussion. What will we do to ensure this project is fun? Board meetings, team meetings, staff meetings. What would it make possible if you actually looked forward to those meetings, if you didn't want to miss them because you'd be missing time to laugh, to play, to explore together? I'm not talking about forced fun like games or warm-up exercises. What would it take for your next board meeting or staff meeting to be more sincerely and matter-of-factly joyful? As you begin exploring these big questions, I hope you will share your observations at Creating the Future's Facebook page at facebook.com/creatingthefuture. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org or on Twitter at Hilde Gottlieb. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For Creating the Future and the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you next month here on Making Change.